This is lecture 9. Remember that there are 10 in special relativity, followed by 5 where I talk about the beginnings of general relativity. So the aim is to get the end of this chapter and chapter 7 on dynamics done in the next two lectures. And we can move straight on at that point. I might drift slightly into lecture 11, but that's not a big problem if it happens. I don't think there are any particular announcements other than to mention and to remind you that the Padlet there exists and is useful. Previous years I found it very useful. By this stage, in previous years, the Padlet has been full of questions. Ask questions. I mean, as I say, I'm not terribly systematic about looking at that every day, but I do aim to look at it fairly regularly, and questions that you put there can be answered, and other folk can see those excellent questions, what you've thought about during the process of mulling things over in your head after the lectures. I shall move on. Are there any questions about where we are? Where we are now, administratively or otherwise? Any questions? Okay. Well, you'll be excellent at asking questions in the lecture, so that's good. Where we got to last time was I had introduced the idea of four vectors as the fairly direct analogue of three vectors in ordinary Euclidean space. There's an x, a y, a z, and a t. And the point I was hammering home was that these vectors in four dimensions have basically the same properties as the vectors you're familiar with, except that the definition of length for these vectors has those extra minus signs. So the definition, I don't think I have a slide which has that on it. Oh yes, I talked of the inner product, or the scalar product, or the dot product, whatever you want to call it. Those, you know, a mathematician would distinguish those various things. We're not going to bother. The dot product of two four vectors has these extra minus signs, which and the matrix of the eta, which has those minus signs in it, the diagonal matrix plus minus is where those minus signs come from. That's called the metric. It's constant for special relativity. It becomes non-constant and of physical interest for general relativity. I noted that the length of the displacement vector, that's delta t dot x dot y dot z, recovers this invariant interval that I talked about several times in previous lectures. So that's interesting, and that shows we're doing something familiar. I talked about the way we did a quick question, which looked at the lengths and inner product of two vectors. We discovered that those two vectors, A and B, were orthogonal to each other in the specific sense that their inner product, the dot product, scalar product, whatever you want to call it, is zero. So that they are as orthogonal in Minkowski space as two right angles, two vectors of right angles would be in three space. And they both have different magnitudes. A has a square length, square magnitude, which is negative, so it's a space-like vector. So it points roughly along the x-axis. The vector B has a positive square magnitude. It's time-like. It points roughly in a sort of time-like along the time-axis direction. And I went on to talk about the derivatives of the displacement vector, and how we can define the relativistic velocity as just the component by component derivative of the position, dx0 by d tau, dx1 by d tau, dx, and so on. We're dividing by d tau, not dt, because it's d tau that is the Lorentz scalar. That's the frame invariant thing. The time between two events is a frame dependent thing, so that we can't divide by that. That changes from frame to frame. But tau, the proper time between two events, is frame invariant, so we can divide by that. It's a scalar under the Lorentz transformation. We can do that twice and get an acceleration. So there's nothing complicated, it is just the component by component derivative. And I worked through the brief calculation that shows that this is another manifestation of time dilation. The rate of change of the time coordinate with proper time is not one. They don't vary in the same way. You can meditate on that a little more. I also mentioned this little notation for velocity, rather than the slightly slangy notation, where the zeroth component of the velocity u0 is gamma, the x component is gamma vx, gamma vy, gamma vz, and so on, and we'll write that in that particular way. And I showed you, I convinced you that the dot product of u with itself, the length of the vector, of the velocity vector, was 1, and because that's true in one frame, and the nice easy frame to calculate, which is the case for an object is not moving, so the velocity vector points along the t-axis, we can easily calculate what u dot u is in that frame, and since it's frame independent, because the scalar product is always frame independent, that's true always, so the velocity vector is strange in that its length is always 1. Unexpectedly. So the point being that as you as something moves at a relativistic speed, its velocity vector doesn't get longer, doesn't change length, it just changes direction in Minkowski space. Right, so that's where we got to last time. Where we're going to go on is appropriately. Okay. I mentioned that u naught was equal to d x naught by d tau, or more generally that u mu is d x mu by d tau. We're reminding you that this index mu, the Greek ones go over 0, 1, 2, 3, Latin ones go 1, 2, 3. So we have the velocity. How do we get the next thing we do is look at the acceleration, vector. That's nice and straightforward. So a naught is going to be d u naught by d tau, before, which is d t by d tau d u naught by dt. I'm going to write this out. And remembering that u is equal to gamma 1 v. U naught is equal to gamma. So this is going to be gamma d gamma by dt gamma dot. I'm not doing anything complicated. That looks slightly fiddly, but I'm not doing anything more complicated than just the chain rule for differentiation. Already you can see this is looking a little messier than the velocity vector. For the spatial components, AI, that's d ui by d tau equals dt by d tau dui by dt, which is gamma d by dt gamma vi. So the ith component of u is just gamma vi from the thing on the right. We differentiate that and we get gamma dot vi plus gamma vi dot, which is gamma gamma dot vi plus gamma ai, defining the ai as the just straightforward derivative with respect to the time coordinate of t. And you can see that looks a bit messier. The relationship between position, velocity, and speed is nice and simple in Newtonian mechanics. It ends up being a bit messier in this case, but it's just because there's a gamma in there messing things up. So okay, that's messy. We don't really want to do calculations with that as much to the extent we can avoid it. But a point worth making is that there is no frame in which a particle is not, if a particle is accelerating, then there's no frame in which it's not accelerating. If a particle is moving at a constant speed, then there's a frame in which it is stationary, but there's no frame in which it's not accelerating. It's accelerating one. I admit that's sort of complicated. If a particle is moving at constant speed, then there is a frame in which that particle is not moving, the frame that's co-moving with the particle. If a particle is accelerating, then there is no frame in which it's not accelerating. It's just accelerating from a different speed. But at any point, there is a frame in which the particle, though accelerating, is briefly at rest. And if you throw something up, then all the way through its motion, it's accelerating. But at the very top of its motion, its vertical speed is zero. So it's momentarily at rest, but it's accelerating. Okay? That's called the momentarily co-moving reference frame, or instantaneously co-moving reference frame. I'll come back to that. Lodge that thought in your head. And now, in that frame, the velocity and acceleration vectors are nice and simple. In that frame, the momentarily co-moving reference frame, the velocity is nice and simple. It's directed entirely along the t-axis. The spatial component of its velocity is zero. It's temporarily at rest. In that frame, also, if we look at this, the velocity is zero and gamma is equal to one. In that frame. So that means, the acceleration is zero, sorry, the velocity is zero, and the gamma is one. So that the acceleration in that frame is gamma is one and gamma dot is, gamma dot, it turns out, contains a factor of v. So gamma dot in that reference frame is zero, and v is zero, gamma dot's zero, so gamma is one. So in that moment, that's a more complicated. In that momentarily co-moving reference, the point is, in that momentarily co-moving reference frame, these are nice and simple. The velocity has zero spatial component, and gamma is one. The acceleration involves a gamma dot, which turns out to be zero in that frame, and just the acceleration. But look what we've found. In that frame, u dot a is equal to zero. It's one times zero minus zero times dot a. So in that frame, u and a are orthogonal. But that's a Lorentz invariant. It's just a number, so it's not frame dependent, so it's true in every frame. So in any frame, the velocity and the acceleration are orthogonal, and that's a technique that this is another variant of choose the right coordinates, which you have will be drummed into you again and again over the course of your physical mathematical career. Pick the right coordinates and problems are simple. Or problems can be made simple. And if you have an invariance, then the answer you get in that simple frame is the answer you get more generally. And that sort of makes sense, because if you remember that the velocity vector is always the same length, u dot u is always 1, and changes in velocity correspond to changing the direction of that vector in Minkowski space, then when something is accelerating, what's happening is not it being that this vector is being extended, it's just being moved. And that sort of makes sense, that the acceleration acting on the velocity would rotate it, if you like, rather than extend it. That's not a detailed mathematical account, but it intended to make this feel a little less strange. All right. Also, in that frame, we can look at what the length of the acceleration vector is. It's just the time component squared minus the space component squared, 0 squared minus a squared. So the acceleration vector is a space-like, it's negative, a space-like vector, the length of which is referred to, is called the proper acceleration. And that's true in this frame, and therefore it's true in every frame, even though in another frame, the components of u would change in that other frame, the components of a would change in that other frame, but in such a way that the dot product of the two would remain the same. The components of the acceleration four vector would be different in a different frame, but the components would change systematically in a way that the dot product would remain at this value. That's what it means, that the dot product is frame invariant. The components of the vectors change, the dot product doesn't. It's a frame invariant quantity. The components are frame dependent, the dot product is frame independent. And that's a very important distinction to have in mind. And I'm not going to go through the details, but if we have two velocity vectors, then we can find a quantity like that. I'm not going to go through the details. If you're interested, it's not terrifically important, but if you're interested, you can look at the notes. And the point here is that these expressions for the acceleration four vector are looking messy. Messy isn't good. They're looking messy. But if we instead fall back on the geometrical properties of these vectors, we can find these clearly very important relations really quite promptly. We didn't have to do a lot of fiddly differentiation here. We didn't have to explicitly change frames here. We just had to be smart, do the calculation in the right frame, get the answer very straightforwardly, and we've discovered a couple of very important, clearly very important properties of these two vectors just from the geometry. Okay? I think that's quite a good example of where the geometry, our geometrical approach, has power. What other slides do we have? That's what I've just shown. Quick question. If I throw a ball vertically into the air, at the top of its path, what is the instantaneously co-moving reference frame? Who would say it was the frame of the room? Who would say it was a frame moving upwards with the same speed as I threw the ball? Who would say it was a frame moving downwards with the ball's terminal velocity? Who hasn't put their hands up yet? Okay, then we'll start again. Guess. I mean, I don't care if you guess wildly. In the moment, you're going to talk to each other and explain why you're right. Who would say it was the frame of the room? Who would say it was a frame moving upwards with the same speed as the frame moving downwards with the terminal velocity? I still haven't seen all those hands. If you have to guess, I don't mind. I just want to see all those hands up. I want you to make some sort of commitment at some point. Who would say it was the frame of the room? Who would say it was the frame moving upwards? Who would say it was the frame moving downwards? That's enough. You talk to your neighbours. So tell them why you're right. Work out what it should be. Okay, and remember, I say again, I don't keep track of who answers what. I don't care. All I'm interested in is the aggregate numbers to see if I'm going about the right speed. Who would say it was the frame of the room? Who would say it was this frame moving upwards with the same speed as the ball? Who would say it was the frame moving downwards with the terminal velocity? Okay, it's the frame of the room, and I think I'm going at the right speed. The frame of the room, because at the point where the ball's at the top of its trajectory, or the pen's at the top of its trajectory, there, the frame in which it's not moving is the frame of the room. So instantaneously at the top of its trajectory, it's not moving vertically. Okay, that's the frame. So the frame in which it's not moving vertically is the instantaneously called moving frame, and that frame is the frame of the room. So does that make sense? Okay. In every other instant, the ball is moving with respect to the room, or the pen or whatever is moving with respect to the room. But only at that instant is the it's an instantaneously good moving reference frame. Key points. Right. Now we're going to go on to an exciting different thing. So that's all very nice and somewhat abstract. I'll just mention in your experience of Newtonian mechanics, you're familiar with acceleration and force and so on being things that you use all the time to solve problems and so on. They turn out not to be, slightly unexpectedly, they turn out not to be terribly useful in relativistic context, partly because they're a bit messy like that. But there is a set of constant acceleration equations in relativity, which I quote in the notes just so you've seen them. But they turn out not to be as useful because, in relativistic context, we don't the sort of puzzle we have to solve, you know, like how fast is this electron moving in the accelerator? How fast is this accretion disk moving around a black hole? They tend not to be constant acceleration type problems, so that tends not to be an important technique. But they do exist, and they're in the notes. Okay. Anyway, moving on. To applications of this. I've mentioned the velocity and acceleration of vectors, and I've said we can derive them fairly straightforwardly, just differentiating the displacement vector component by component. Nice and straightforward, but I have just admitted they're not terrifically useful for solving problems. But there is another important vector which we can look at quite closely and discover useful things immediately. What I'm going to do is, so imagine a set of wave fronts. And we're not necessarily talking about these being relativistic, but they could be in water or whatever. But right now, we'll be completely generic about what these are waves of. The wave fronts. And there's a wavelength, of course. There's a direction, a spatial direction, n. That's LMN type vector. I could write that in. Is that a vector? Nothing special about that vector. I'm going to imagine two successive events on this wavefront, and then a little while later, when the waves have moved on a bit, on an event on another wavefront. And we're going to ask, what is the displacement between those two events? We're going to call that delta R. And that delta R is going to be delta T, delta X, delta Y, delta Z, in the expected fashion. Now, in the time, this wavefront is moving at a speed u. Of velocity u. So in a time delta t, each wavefront will have moved forward a distance u dot t. So the length between 1 and 2 is going to be u delta t plus n lambda, where n is the number of wavefronts we're talking about. Okay, so we're building up this construction step by step. But that spatial separation between 1 and 2 is also just n dot delta r, which is equal to l delta t plus m delta, sorry, m delta x plus m delta y plus n delta z. Okay, that's just the length or two different ways of getting the length of the spatial distance between these two events. And if we rearrange that a bit, we get u delta t minus l delta x minus m delta y minus n delta z equals minus n lambda. And you could, from the pattern of signs, you can probably see where this is going. And we can divide through by lambda and write f is equal to u for lambda, that f delta t minus l over lambda delta x minus m over lambda delta y minus n over lambda delta z is equal to minus n. And we can write that as l dot delta r, where delta r is this thing here, as before, and l, squeeze it in the bottom here, is f l over lambda m over lambda n over lambda. So if I, the point is, if I define this thing L in this way, then, and recall the definition of delta R as above, then L dot R is equal to this thing here. Okay, that's suggestive. This looks a bit like a bit like a vector, but is it a vector, or is it just some numbers in a row? I'll look at that. Let's look at that just to help to digest that a bit. Imagine some water waves move along the x-axis at speed 10 meters a second with wavelength 5 meters. What's its frequency flow vector? We're going to let's all just stare at that for a moment, and then I'll get you to talk to each other. And what I'll do is I'll put the other thing on one, the other thing. So looking at this, so what's the frequency flow vector of in that situation? Okay. Who would say it was the first one? Who would say it was the second one? Who would say it was the third one? Okay. I'm just going to, I don't trust my own arithmetic, so I'm just going to go straight to the answer. It's moving along the x-axis, so n is equal to 1. The frequency is 2 hertz, 10 meters a second divided by 5 meters. And so that means that the u over lambda, first component over lambda is a fifth. So it'll be 2 1/5 0 0. I mean, don't worry if you've got that. When I was doing that with you, I got it wrong as well because my arithmetic's rubbish. But the point is, there's nothing particularly exotic about this frequency 4 vector. It's just the sort of fairly obvious thing. Okay. Now, so where we got to is this. So I'm going to write that down again. L is equal to F L over lambda M over lambda N over lambda, and delta R is equal to delta T delta X delta Y delta Z. And we worked out that L dot delta R is equal to minus N, and that, which is just a number. But look back to the beginning of this chapter, and one of the things that I showed you was that the components of a vector in one frame turn into components of the same vector in another frame when they're acted upon by the transformation matrix, big lambda. And so the components of delta R, delta X, delta Y, delta Z, in terms of the components of the same vector in another frame, are going to be D prime plus gamma delta X primed plus V delta T primed delta Y prime delta Z prime. Now, we know that simply because R is our prototype 4 vector. The displacement vector is our prototype 4 vector, and we deduced that its components transformed in this particular way. I'm falling behind time here. I'm talking too much. Now, we can substitute that into this expression here, and then we'd rearrange it, and we end up with dot delta R equal to gamma F minus V 1 over lambda, that's L over lambda, gamma L over lambda minus P F M over lambda N over lambda dot delta R primed. So all I've done there is substitute that back into L dot R equals minus N, and we get this same thing is this expression here. After a bit of rearrangement, I encourage you to go through the steps of that just to reassure yourself that I'm not pulling a fast one. But what we've got here is the L primed that we would get if we took L prime equal to lambda L, where lambda is the transformation matrix that gets us this. And so that is L primed dot R primed. So just to repeat, what I'm doing there is if we took the components of L up at the top there and acted upon them with the same matrix that got us that transformed delta R, what we would get is L primed with these components here. So what we discovered is that this vector L, we defined at the top, transforms in the same way as a 4 vector. It behaves the same way as the displacement vector. It's a 4 vector, in other words. Okay. Now, is that not sort of inevitable? Am I saying something trivial here? No, I'm not. Because if I were to say that, I don't see what F is doing in that definition of L. Okay, it seems pointless. Let's just define L, because I want to be zero. L over lambda, M over lambda, N over lambda. Why shouldn't I do that? Why shouldn't I do that? Because if I do this same process here and operate on that with the transformation matrix L, lambda rather, what I get is we'll have a non-zero component in the time slot. It'll have changed its form. And moreover, this property of the dot product with delta R wouldn't remain frame invariant. In other words, it's only when we include that F, that non-zero with the frequency, in the frequency 4 vector, that we get these correct properties of a vector. So this is behaving like a 4 vector, is the point. By its behavior shall you know it. Okay? And that's called the frequency 4 vector. And it's an important thing. Now, next thing is, imagine we had a wave train moving, as before, and in a primed frame, it's moving at speed at an angle theta with respect to the x prime axis. In that frame, then, the 4 vector would be its frequency in that frame, cos theta prime over lambda, sin theta prime over lambda. That's going to be its the 4 vector describing the motion in the prime frame when it's moving with an angle theta primed to the x-axis. So it's moving in that direction, like that. Okay. What then would that look like in the unprimed frame, in the frame with respect to which that frame is moving? That L is equal to L transformation on L primed equals what it equals. But that is also the case that in this frame, in the frame with respect to which the prime frame is moving, the same wave train is going to have a frequency. It's going to be moving at an angle. These are all primed as well. It's going to move at an angle theta, not theta primed, sine theta over lambda, zero. And we can compare these two expressions for L, component by component, to get the frequency in the... Thank you. The frequency in the prime frame as a function... frequency in the unprimed frame as a function of the frequency in the prime frame. This factor gamma, 1 plus V cos theta over the frequency of the wave train in that frame. And a similar expression for the change in the angle. In other words, simply by virtue of regarding the 4 vector as the frequency 4 vector as a 4 vector, that tells us we're allowed to relate the components of that frequency of that vector in the prime frame, L prime, and deduce the bit I've missed out, the dot dot dot, deduce what the components of that same vector are in the unprime frame, and compare them to what we decide that we're going to call those components in this frame, and so get a way of transforming the frequency from one frame to another. And then we're getting toward the point here. And because I'm running out of time, I'm not going to go through the blow-by-blow details, but we can discover that the length of the 4 vector is k. Yep, What do I miss out? Okay, I'll skip a bit about talk and talk about the important case where the wave frame in question is a light wave moving at the speed of light. Okay, so the velocity u is equal to 1. And the bit I missed out is where it's a question there. Is v cos theta primed over u primed? But that u is the speed of the wave train. But what we're interested in really is the special case where the wave train is moving at the speed of light. It's a light wave, and in that case, this expression changes, simplifies to f is equal to f primed gamma 1 plus v cos theta, and cos theta equals plus v over 1 plus e cos theta prime, where v is the
is it gamma times that or is it gamma of that?
Oh, gamma times that, yes, good point. Yes, so it's just gamma of v, where v is the relative speed between the two frames. Thank you. Yes. And that is a nice way. There are other ways of doing it. If you look at Carroll and Ostley, the recommended book, they do a different way of deriving this, which I think is much messier. But this way, we have deduced this relativistic Doppler shift directly from the requirement that the frequency 4 vector is a 4 vector. So the first equation we wrote in this chapter, the beginning of chapter 8, about the transformation of vectors from one frame to another, is what lets this pop out. And you are familiar with the Doppler shift for sound waves. You're familiar with the Doppler shift for light waves. For example, you can tell how fast a galaxy is moving by looking at the Doppler shift from the light emitted from things on the edge of the galaxy, and so on. I mean, these are the staples of observational astronomy. That Doppler shift is just the non-relativistic limit of this expression here, with the theta in question being a nice straightforward line of sight zero or 180 degrees or whatever you want. So I'm going to in the remaining 5 minutes, having rushed there. This is the relativistic Doppler shift. It's a very important and directly observable feature of the change of frequency and wavelength and the direction of light when you move from one frame to another. It's directly observable. You can see that. You learned in last year in astronomy last year how to use the Doppler shift to measure the speeds of things at astronomical distances, and the fact that the direction changes. The direction of starlight changes depending on what direction the Earth is moving in, because theta changes depending on whether the Earth is moving in that part of its orbit or in this part of its orbit. The change in direction is not much. That particular aberration is not much. But it was detected in the 18th century. People were able to make precise enough measurements of the precise enough astrometric measurements of the direction of stars at different times of the year to detect that there was an anomaly over the course of the year, which was this relativistic aberration. And you can detect this in a laboratory. It's very easy to detect the non-relativistic Doppler shift, the longitudinal Doppler shift, where theta is zero or pi. Very easy to detect that. Things just change speed, change colour. Very obviously, it's much less easy to detect the transverse Doppler shift, because as something is moving past you, perpendicular to the line of sight, There's a zero classical Doppler shift there, because it's not moving toward you. So the only Doppler shift you get is because of time dilation. Effectively because of time dilation. And that's a very small effect. And it's very hard to measure. But it was detected in 1932, I think, by Truffaut, Ives and Stilwell, at Bell Labs, in fact. So there were industrial researchers, and they managed to detect this effect, and that was one of the early straightforward observational confirmations of relativistic effects in a laboratory. So this is very, very practical, very, very, very straightforwardly detectable, an immediate consequence of relativity in the laboratory. I am going to stop there because I've run out of time. I had hoped to get on to chapter 9 in this lecture. I think it would be ambitious to get all the way through chapter 7, I mean. I think we're ambitious to get all the way through that next time. So I think we will eat into lecture 11 a bit. But I aim to get through chapter 7 fairly briskly. So it would be a good idea to look at that before next lecture.